is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Welcome to The Big Picture as we return to a topic that's very much in the news today, and that is global growth, and we're going to talk about why it's slowing down. Recent reports out from the World Bank and the IMF all point to a clear slowdown just about everywhere you look, not only here in the U.S., but also in Europe, China, Japan, and much of Asia. Many of these regions and countries are more dependent on global trade than the U.S., which, of course, is more self-reliant. So what this means for the stock market, our economy, and investments in general, that's going to be the topic of today's Big Picture.
And this is something, Chris, I wanted to cover this topic because, like the events here, so much of what is happening in our economy and our markets, if you think about it over the last 10 years, is related to government policy. And you take a look at the economic recovery, whether it was the massive fiscal stimulus that we saw in 2009 and once again in 2018, and of course this year, but also Fed QE and now, of course, Fed QT. So, you know, when we think about it, 3 months ago, central banks from our own Fed to the ECB were talking about tightening, raising interest rates, only to reverse themselves since the beginning of the year. So what has caused the abrupt change in policy? That's a big question. What is lurking out there that is perceived as a danger, and why have interest rates gone negative, and in the case here in the U.S., inverted recently? Something is going on that has raised the alarm. And I guess the question everybody's asking, what do they know that we don't? What is it? So as we discussed last week on the program and recently with our interviews on FS Insider, you know, here's the thing that makes this really difficult. As Jim Paulson said, this is probably the quirkiest economic recovery he has seen in his entire career. And of course, we've had noted economist and strategist Dave Rosenberg recently on the program, and he's going against the grain, along with one other economist we've had on the program, Gary Schilling. Rosenberg, on a recent program less than 2 weeks ago, said he believes 85% chance of a recession this year. So there are concerns, Chris, out there, and the key is assessing where the vulnerabilities is. In other words, you almost wish you could have been a fly on the wall in the latest FOMC meeting, or at least one in January. How could they go in a matter of weeks to being extremely hawkish to extremely dovish? In other words, what's out there that we aren't seeing or is lurking out there that we don't know about?
Well, like you said, Jim, something is going on. And if you had to venture a guess, what do you think are the reasons why we've seen that major slowdown? And even the abrupt change at central banks like the ECB and the Fed. I mean, if you were just to come up with a reason that comes to mind, what would that be?
You know, I think there's a clear reason behind it. Plain and simple, the world economy is loaded with massive amounts of debt. There was a recent article in Bloomberg, and they talked about world debt now exceeds 318% of GDP. Non-financial debt is at a record high of 92% of GDP, and total global debt, brace yourself, is hovering around $244 trillion as of the end of 2018, which is more than three times the size of the global economy. Now, this debt has risen substantially when you think about it from the last downturn, because we heard early on in this recovery, one of the reasons the recovery was so weak, there was so much debt and people were paying down debt. And in many cases, that was the case. Consumers were paying down debt. Corporations were reluctant to borrow, which is why the Fed started QE1, QE2. What the Fed was trying to do is bring down long-term interest rates in an effort to get the credit cycle moving again. And here's the problem with that. When you have low interest rates in borrowing with a lot of debt that is stimulated by artificially low rates, you end up having a problem surface later on. It's kind of like diseases. We know that if you smoke continuously or you eat fatty food, sooner or later you're going to run into problems. As the noted Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises told in his business cycle theory, he talked about any time you have an extended period of artificially low interest rates, what does that do? It induces businesses to make investments that are not economic and are only possible with artificially low interest rates. So these low interest rates causes what we call malinvestments to be made that are only sustainable as a result of artificially low interest rates. Now, when central banks go in the reverse direction and they start raising rates, as the Fed and other central banks have been doing up till recently, the higher cost of borrowing reveals that many of these projects cannot be completed profitably. Sometimes it'll force the businesses to either scale back or abandon their activities as they're doing now or face heavy losses. The rise in interest rates, what it does, it exposes the vulnerabilities of these bad investments. You know, I can give you a couple examples. Think of real estate in the last decade, or more recently, shale in the energy patch. Just as we discussed on this program last week in the interview with author Bethany McLean in her book, Saudi America. As she pointed out clearly, the only reason shale was made possible was because of the artificial low interest rates that came about as a result of the great financial crisis. Over 80% of the companies in the shale play have negative cash flow, and they actually spend more than they're actually taking in. Shale production here in the U.S. is grossly overstated, and more importantly, as these prices have come down, as we saw in the last quarter, drilling activity has slowed down. And there's some questions about some of the numbers that have been overstated by the Energy Information Agency. So here's a question. If all of this drilling and all of these companies that are involved in shale have been made possible as a result of low debt, what happens if the economy slows down and they're not able to roll over their debt at a lower interest rate?
I agree. And Jim, the thing that comes to mind here is just what a big deal it was that the Fed backed off. I mean, you said one of the risks this year was a possible policy mistake. But since the Fed has backed off from their hawkish statement of last fall, I mean, you can just feel the relief in that regard. But as you and Greg Weldon discussed in the first hour, they still may have gone too far by raising rates last December. But hasn't that risk been removed?
Not really. I mean, just this week, the IMF said, and I'm quoting here, "We are at a delicate moment for the global economy. There's grave danger from not only Trump's trade war, which is having a sphere effect on global trade, but not to mention the cost pressures here in the U.S. Remember when they, you know, what is it, $200 billion that there's been a 25% tariff slapped on? You know, that's raising the cost for manufacturers. Then on top of that, you throw in Brexit, which could end up in a mess. So what really stands out here quickly is how things have changed. In 2017, it was the first year of the Trump presidency, 75% of global economies were experiencing an upsurge in growth. And that even includes anemic economies like Japan and some of the economies, smaller economies in Europe. It was a brief moment. It lasted roughly about a year. Now, according to the recent report by the IMF, 70% of global economies are now experiencing a slowdown. The global economy has lost further momentum since January, according to Christine Lagarde, head of the IMF. And she went on further to emphasize, once again, we are at a delicate moment that requires us to handle with care. This means that we must not only avoid a policy mistake, but also make sure we make the right policy steps. And Chris, that just came out this week.
You had me thinking, Jim. I mean, when we look at how we've been talking about this last week, we covered how many of the indicators here have softened. Even the GDP was on a downward trajectory ever since Q2 of last year. But, you know, things don't happen in a vacuum. We talk about what's happening in the United States. We also look at the global impact. So what does this look like when you do look globally?
And this is one of the reasons why you've seen the World Bank, you've seen the IMF, both have come out and reduced their economic forecast for the year. And it's also, for example, we get Moody's Analytics, and they follow global indicators just as they do domestic indicators. Globally, we've gone from 3.5% down to 2.7%, with a lower figure forecasted for the first quarter of this year. Now, if you want to look at developed economies, we've gone from 2.7% to 1.8%. Now, obviously, the United States is boosting that up because last year we got close to 3% growth. And if you're talking about even emerging markets, less developed economies, they've gone from 4.6% to 3.8%. So economists are citing that the global economy weakened in the second half of the year. It happened here, it happened over there. and they attribute a lot of this to the trade tensions between the U.S. and China, which is obviously having a greater impact on Europe and, let's say, for Asia, because they're more dependent on exports than the U.S. is. Now, according to Moody's, in their latest business survey, confidence stood at 18% last week, which I really found that figure fascinating, because if you take a look at last year, our economy grew at 3%. Economies in the globe were still growing. We're not in a recession. They may have slowed down. Unemployment is at the lowest level we've seen in four decades. So whenever you get below 20%, it's usually an indication that economies are contracting or slowing down. And economists here are talking about weakness in the first quarter. They also see weakness in the first half.
Now, Jim, did they give any reason for that? I mean, did that just come out of nowhere?
No, I mean, they cite three things. Seasonality, and we've seen this in this economic recovery. The economy picks up. The second and third quarters tend to be the strongest quarters of the year. It starts to slow down in Q4. Did that again last year. They talk about seasonality. You know, a lot of people, if you think about Christmas, people go into debt. They charge things for Christmas. And guess what happens in January? The bills come. Also, what happens in the first quarter of the year, you're filing your income tax return. And we've reported that income tax refunds were lower this year. And in many cases, if you're making a certain level of income, you actually saw your taxes go up. So we've been talking to quite a few clients during this tax season. And as a result, if you live in states like New Jersey, Illinois, New York, California, you might have seen your taxes actually go up, which means your accountant is saying, hey, you need to fork over more dough. So seasonality played into this. A second thing they talked about was the partial government shutdown, which probably knocked down about 0.5% off U.S. GDP. Tax refunds, I mentioned, were lower. And then, of course, they cited the trade war between the U.S. and China.
Well, and you were talking about the risk of a trade war, Jim, and I was noting that the Wall Street Journal had an article out about how the U.S. and China, they're trying to reach a trade deal here in the next 4 weeks. I have a clip here from Mark Zandes, the chief economist. He commented on the risk of a trade war and a recession.
I'll say, Mandy, if we don't get a deal, if I'm wrong, and obviously with President Trump, I could definitely be wrong, that's the fodder for a global recession. I think the global trade war, this trade war has done significant damage to the global economy, and things are very fragile. And if we don't settle, if the President Trump and Xi don't settle this pretty soon, we got a big problem.
And here's a smattering of different strategists echoing this same theme.
I said in Steve Leisman's Fed survey that if Trump wants to be a two-term president, he needs to come to a trade agreement with China and then start lowering tariffs across the board. That will reaccelerate this economy. It will cause CEO confidence to spike, resulting in a resumption of business investment, which has really been the missing ingredient in this 10-year expansion. We've had such little business investment until late 17 and early 18, but then the talk of tariffs and actual trade action kind of put a hold on that.
Yeah, and I think it's time to take profits, really. China, optimism is baked in terms of the trade accord. It's now increasingly consensus. This was our top recommendation coming into this year. And consumer discretionary in China and Chinese equities is up 32%. And I think, yeah, it's really time to look at realizing those profits and putting that money to work in Latin America, which really hasn't seen that as steep an appreciation as China. Let's face it, Europe hasn't done the homework. So of the three majors in the developed markets, U.S., Japan, and Europe, U.S. and Japan have made structural reforms. Tax reform is the primary reason why you had business investment jump, which your previous guest mentioned. I think that's a critical part of the strong acceleration that we've had in the U.S. economy.
A lot of it depends on how much of the weakness from overseas starts to wash up on our shores. I think the Fed is getting a sense of that, as is investors, and we're starting to see the dollar slip as a result of that, notwithstanding some of the move today. So the question is, are we still insulated? But I will say that the announcement the Fed said standing pat for the rest of the year is unprecedented. I've never really, that's something that maybe Mario Draghi would say, but not necessarily a Fed chairman.
As those economists were citing, Chris, there are so many possibilities of policy mistakes here from let's say, trade wars, shutting down the borders, Brexit, to massive, and I mean massive, taxes if Democrats capture the White House and take complete control of Congress. Now, just going on what they're proposing, they're talking about a 2-3% annual wealth tax, higher estate taxes, lowering the exemption back to $3.5 million, and recently this week on Tuesday, a annual capital gains tax assessed on any asset that appreciates, whether it's sold or not. And this new tax scheme was revealed on Tuesday by Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon. He's the top Democrat on the Senate's Tax Writing Committee. Now, what he's proposing is taxing unrealized gains in investments every year at the same rates as ordinary income. Now, right now, the top capital gains tax rate is 23.8%. He's talking about taxing unrealized gains at rates up to 37%. So a lot of the top Democratic presidential contenders are running on massive new entitlements, lots of free stuff that would be paid for by massive new taxes. This would be probably, at least in my opinion, a major policy blunder to enact on an economy that is weakening and one that is leveraged as the U.S. economy is currently.
Jim, where do you think this uncertainty comes from? I mean, a lot of times we know that the things that move the market typically has to do with uncertainty. What comes to mind for me are the trade wars that we talked about. Brexit's been all over the news recently. You've got possible massive tax hikes. Could it be like the unpredictable policies of the central banks? What do you think is really moving the needle here?
You know, Chris, when you take it all of them, I don't think you can put your finger on just one. I think it's all of the above. Once again, this has been one of the most unusual and more difficult economic recoveries to navigate, as so much of it has been driven by government fiscal policy. Think 2009, think 2018 with the Trump tax cuts and also the fiscal spending increases. And not to mention these crazy central bank policies of stuff we haven't even seen up until recently in my entire almost four decades in the business. And I want to go back to the Moody's survey of business confidence, which really struck me when I read the latest confidence survey this week. I was just astonished at the low confidence levels right now, given the fact that, once again, the economies are still growing. We're not in a recession. Interest rates, even though the Fed has raised them, you know, here's the interesting thing. Do you know, Chris, that the yield on the 10-year bond is lower today than when it was when Janet Yellen first raised interest rates in 2015? And I'm talking about confidence levels that go back to where they were when we were coming out of a recession in 2009. I think that's the one that really surprised me when looking at this survey, because I'm trying to think, there's nothing really that has been bad that has happened that could shock people, other than maybe, let's say, the huge volatility that we've seen in the last 3 months of the year, as well as the reverse volatility that we've seen in the first 3 months of this year. The problem is, businesses are nervous around the globe. I don't care if you're looking at various confidence surveys. And the trade war is unsettling in business in Asia and North America, from the U.S. to Canada. I mean, you know, if you're doing business and the president's talking about shutting down the border, what are you thinking? In another confidence survey, and this one was done with major chief financial officers at Fortune 500 companies, it was done by the big accounting firm Deloitte. According to the survey, 24% of CFOs said they are altering or delaying making investments as a means of preparing for a business downturn, and their expectations for the future remain dim. So these guys aren't confident. And let me explain the importance of business and consumer confidence surveys. Now, we consider these sort of what we call soft economic data. It's not hard data like the ISM, industrial production, things like that. But one thing investors and markets thrive on is certainty. It's the same for businesses. When the tax laws are uncertain, or you're hearing in this presidential campaign about almost a complete reversal and going to the opposite end and extreme, or may change negatively, or, for example, as we heard and we saw the impact on the markets last fall when the Fed started giving very hawkish statements in their FOMC press conferences and also in their statements. If I was a CEO of a company and my CFO comes to me, he's telling me costs are rising, sales are slowing, cash flow is decreasing, and the company is seeing weakness in many of its business segments, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to do exactly what the survey says they're doing, which is to hold back on investments or making any major commitments to expand when the future outlook is so cloudy. And here's where the real danger lies. If confidence is lost or it starts to decline for too long, it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Think what happens. Consumers hold back on spending. They start saving. Investors pull back or they're fearing a bear market or losses. So they either delay making investments or they sell out their positions. Businesses may delay or postpone needed investments. I mean, take a look at what happened to the oil industry between 2014 and 2016. And it almost becomes it just sort of feeds on itself. And the next thing you know it, you're in a bear market and a recession. So confidence is important. And the longer this goes on, this uncertainty that's out there right now, this cloud over what's going to happen on global trade, this cloud that is starting to surface in terms of who wins the White House and the policies that will be implemented. That is one reason, Chris, we're watching credit spreads, the lending markets, to see what happens to credit. In other words, interest rates have come down, which is helping the housing market. And we've seen a little bit of uptick in housing. Now, will that translate to the auto market? Will it translate to business borrowing? So the reason the World Bank and the IMF are so concerned about these, the potential for policy mistakes, is not only the degree of leverage, which we've highlighted here in the program, but they do not have the policy options that they had in the last recession when interest rates were much higher. I mean, right now, negative sovereign debt is over $10 trillion. That's $10 trillion of sovereign debt. When you loan money to the government, you get back less than what you gave the government. A 10-year German government bond has a yield of 1 basis point. That's 0.01%. A Japanese 10-year bond has a negative interest rate of 5 basis points. And here we are. The interest rates are the lowest they've been in human recorded history. That's the thing that really I think I found most remarkable when I was reading, whether it was the Deloitte survey or it was the Moody's Analytics survey of global businesses, the pessimism that is out there, given the fact, Chris, we're not even in a recession. We haven't had a financial crisis. The stock market is up. And that's, I think, is what stands out.
Well, and I should also note, whether we're talking about the Japanese yen or the German bund, we get a lot of feedback from our listeners that they really like when we talk about buns. So, Jim, if central banks... Cinnabuns are maybe our we get the most feedback from. That's correct. But I wanted to ask, Jim, if central banks have run out of ammunition, which appears to be the case, very little room to adjust interest rates, what policy choices or responses are left out there to combat the next downturn? I think that's probably on a lot of folks' minds.
You know, this was something that Greg Weldon and I talked about in the first hour. Greg feels this. I feel this. We're entering what we call the final stages of the end game. That is why you are starting to hear, and you're going to hear a lot more about this. In fact, we're going to do a couple shows with some experts on this, modern monetary theory in the future. There is simply just too much debt out there for the credit cycle to function as it has in the past. And the best example I can give you is this recovery. It took the Fed, QE1, QE2, QE3, to drive down long-term interest rates to the lowest point in recorded history to revitalize the credit cycle. And the reason, there was just simply way too much debt. Interest rates are still, even despite the increases, at historic low levels. And I doubt if lowering interest rates in the next downturn to zero or buying more bonds is going to do the trick. So right now, what do you have? You have politicians, and I might add, in both parties, are talking about modern monetary theory. And if we take it, first of all, it's not a new theory. It's been around for a long time. It's basically reflation. The government spends massive amounts of money. It issues debt, and the Fed or any central bank prints money and buys the government bonds to pay for the spending. So every proposal that you're seeing, the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, free college, guaranteed monthly income, all of the proponents of these programs cite MMT as the means for paying all of it along with massive taxes. And it's basically spend, tax, and print, and it's been given a new name for a prescription for inflating away the debt. Is proponents cite, they say, hey, look, when the Fed lowers interest rates, you may not necessarily go out and borrow money. But if we create money and we spend it, they can inject it directly into the economy at a faster rate than interest rates, with more immediate and predictable effect. So watch in the next year. You are going to see, I don't care if it's President Trump or it's going to be the Democrats, they're going to be talking about MMT to justify the new spending programs. And since a government like the U.S., and this is where the theory goes, issues its debt in its own currency. In other words, when the U.S. Treasury has to raise $1 trillion to finance the deficit, they don't go to Europe and raise it in euros or Japanese yen or Chinese renminbi. They raise it in U.S. dollars. So the politicians arguing for MMT as a means of paying for these massive spending programs, they basically want to end monetary policy because essentially MMT would be inflationary. Now think about that for a moment. If inflation rises, what do you think the central bank's going to do? You're going to hear them talking about inflation as a risk. You're going to hear them talking about raising interest rates. So what good would it do? And this is one of the examples I can give you is the last probably 12 months. What have you heard Trump say? Hey, we just created this stimulus and the Fed got aggressive in raising interest rates. That's what they do. So the MMTers argue that government spending and taxation are more effective way to keep inflation down when combined with wage and price controls. Now, if you're old enough as I am, we tried this in the 70s under President Nixon and Carter, and it ended up with high inflation. The CPI in 1979 and 80 got to be 14%. President Carter put in a 7% limitation on wage increases. We put in, President Nixon did price controls. And the Fed was trying to maintain low interest rates through debt monetization. So it doesn't work and may now be necessary to inflate away this massive amount of government debt. Remember, our deficit right now, our debt is over $22 trillion, growing at nearly $1 trillion a year. So the reflation crowd now has a new theory to justify what may be coming our way in the future. And I want to point out, it's not just here, but also globally. And I think the country that's probably in the worst situation is probably Europe, because it's already dealing with negative interest rates. So there are very few options other than physical reflation. But the problem with Europe, it's not a complete union. It's a monetary union. It's not a fiscal union. So what are they going to do?
Well, it's just so strange, Jim, when you mention MMT. Just personally speaking, when we talk about this, I'm just struck by how people aren't more concerned about it in general. And it really brings us back to how we began the show today. I mean, the global economy's peaked, according to most experts. And even some voices like Gary Schilling and Dave Rosenberg, they feel there's a greater probability of recession this year. In fact, I want to play both of those clips here as these two strategists are going against the consensus. And they have a history of calling market bubbles, tops, and peaks in the economy.
The aha moment I had that really ratified my recession call, okay, I'm not saying it's 100%, I'll call it 85%. Those odds are pretty high. This is a high conviction call, was the Fed Loan Officer Survey for the first quarter. The Fed Loan Officer Survey for the first quarter showed, A, the banks tightening credit standards across every line of business. But what caught my eye was that whether it was commercial real estate loans, commercial and industrial loans, credit card loans, residential mortgages or auto loans, the demand for credit across the board was either slowing or contracting. So I think we're going into the early stages, and it's not going to be anything like 08 or 09, don't get me wrong. But I think after this monumental debt cycle that we've had, especially in the corporate sector, we're going into the other side of that, and that the theme this year and probably into next year is going to be one of debt deleveraging.
You think the probabilities are about two-thirds. Gary, what could change your mind on that?
All things come to an end, the economic expansions, recessions, what have you. But in terms of recession in this year, what could postpone it to 2020 or even later would probably be consumers hanging in there and perhaps some trade deal with China that made everybody very happy. And you got a revival in the stock market and general optimism returning.
So as it currently stands, what we do know right now is that the U.S. economy has slowed down considerably, and that's the same for overseas economies. I was talking about comparing the United States to the global economy. And even if more in the developed world, like Europe and Japan. So some of the risks that you've identified, Jim, at the beginning of the year, for example, political discord, they've been removed now that the Mueller report cleared the president of possible impeachment, although I should mention, it seems like it's going to be in a mode of investigate instead of legislate, which means it's highly unlikely that we'll see any further stimulus coming out of Washington, at least prior to the next presidential election. This leaves the final risk of trade war. And I want to get your opinion on this, Jim. And again, we've kind of peppered this topic throughout our discussion today. But what do you think are the possibilities that this too just goes away, gets removed? And then if it does, what does that do for the economy and the global economies and markets if it does get resolved?
You know, I think there's a good chance that it's going to get resolved, as it's hurting, number one, as the IMF and everybody knows, it's hurting global trade. The president is hearing that from world leaders, the IMF, the World Bank. He's hearing it from business leaders. He knows that. And you got to remember, Chris, he's running for re-election. Hmm. And he knows better than anyone else what the risk of a recession would do to his re-election chances. If we're in a recession come the fall of 2020, he can forget a second term. So I expect that this will get resolved by early summer because, as Mark Zandi talked about in that clip you played, if this continues until the fall or the end of the year, it raises the chance of a recession in 2020, if not before then.
So let's go ahead and bring this down to investors. What should investors be doing at this time?
You know, once again, Chris, our position hasn't changed here. If you've been listening to us since the beginning of the year, we remain defensively positioned. We own short-term sovereign debt. We own high dividend-paying stocks, deep beaten-down value plays, and a position we are gradually building in commodities such as gold, copper, and energy. In fact, we were just meeting in our bullpen this week. We've got three commodity plays that we're waiting to come into their area where we're going to be buying. So we're playing that. And especially if this trade deal gets done, it is going to be very bullish for emerging markets and commodities.
Well, coming up in Big Picture Part 2, there is something happening here.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, Jim, I thought I'd start out with a great quote here. Here it goes. There's something happening here. What it is isn't exactly clear. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds, getting so much resistance from behind. What do you think of that, Jim?
Sounds like a song.
It is.
You gonna sing it, Chris?
Well, I thought we'd start out with a duet. We can just have our maestro here start with a piano intro.
Folks, it's amazing what you do to boost your ratings.
Actually, Jim, those were the lyrics to a Buffalo Springfield song. It was released in 1966, but I thought it was appropriate to start out this segment with those lyrics as we pick up on a point that was made by Greg Weldon in the first hour. Really about the fact that something isn't right here when you look at the markets. And so that song came to mind.
Oh boy, I remember that. Brings you back to your youthful days. But you know, what we were talking about in the first hour is there are so many cross currents that are going on in the financial markets right now. You have, and let me just go through a couple of them. You have negative interest rates in Europe with the German Bund with an interest rate of just one basis point, Much of the debt in Europe sovereigns is either negative or at historically low interest rates. Same thing when you take a look at Japan. And of course, here you have an inversion of the yield curve at the short end. And last week, for about a day or two, we had an inversion at the long end. So if you look at the financial markets right now, you have falling interest rates, narrowing credit spreads, rising global stock markets, rising commodity prices, which have accentuated by this V-shaped recovery we're seeing in just about every single asset class. Chris, almost the, when I say V-shape, it was almost like the steep fall that we saw in all asset classes last fall. And at the same time, you've got corporate profits, they're thinning as wages rise, and the rising dollar, that's eating into a lot of the S&P 500 companies, which get about 40% of their sales overseas. As we talked in the first segment, economic growth is slowing down here and abroad, and also there's greater risk of a recession. So in addition, within the stock market, you have these traditional risk assets doing well, like technology and junk bonds. But you also have safe assets like REITs, utilities, consumer staples, and even gold, which is a sort of a safe haven asset. They're also doing well. So you have risk assets doing well, safe assets doing well. And some or all of these indicators and asset classes, here's the point, cannot continue in this fashion before a real trend emerges as to which asset class is the real story going on here.
So with those different indicators, Jim, what are you focusing on? I mean, if you're looking for an answer to how this whole thing plays out, where would be your focus? What would you be watching?
I don't know. We're just running blind.
Okay. Well, we need another indicator then.
Okay. Now, once again, it's probably the credit markets that will telegraph the problem whenever it emerges. And Chris, it always does. The other market we're watching closely is the commodity market, in particular, the gold market. Now, right now, gold has corrected after trying to break through the 1350 level, but is hugging close to 1300. So we're starting to see some strength in the price of gold. Don't expect a breakout, however, until the dollar starts to break down. Dollar has been going down now with those comments coming, the dovish comments coming from the Fed, because all of last year we saw a strengthening dollar, and that was based on the fact that, you know, if you take a look at U.S. sovereign debt, let's put it this way. A U.S. 10-year Treasury bond is around 2.5%. A 10-year Treasury bond in Germany is 1 basis point. So treasuries are 249 basis points above a German bond. And in Japan, the 10-year is actually negative.
So you mentioned that it's the credit markets that will telegraph that problem wherever it emerges and whenever it emerges. And I've heard Chris Paplava also really stress that that's just something you really want to focus on. And why? Why the emphasis on the credit and bond markets?
Well, let's just take a look at the history. And I'll just take the last 10 years. Whenever trouble breaks out, it begins there. It telegraphs what will be happening next. So if, for example, you look at last fall when credit spreads began to widen and started to rise last summer, by fall, we had a problem. It showed up in all asset classes, from bonds, stocks, to commodities. Go back to 2015. In the fall, credit spreads began to widen once again. And by the beginning of 2016, the stock market started the year on a down note and fell every week for 6 weeks, causing the Fed, by the way, to back off its intended rate hikes, just as the same thing happened this year when the Fed had to back off after the blowout in credit spreads last winter. And if you want to go back even further, go back to 2011, when we got a 20% correction in the stock market by the end of the summer in early fall. Back then, it was really looking, Chris, that the economy could be heading into a recession. I mean, think of all the things that were happening. We had Fukushima. We had the Arab Spring. Oil prices were at $110 a barrel. September, Standard & Poor's downgraded U.S. Treasuries to BB from AAA. And then we had the pig crisis break out in Europe. All of that was reflected in the credit markets. Hard to believe. The Greek bond yields got to as high as 30%. And much of Europe was paying an interest rate like Portugal. The pig countries were 8, 9, 10, and 12% compared to negative interest rates today. So it all showed up in the credit and the bond markets first. And I just, you know, over my career, I have found following the credit markets and the bond market has probably been one of the best indicators of spotting trouble before it begins.
And we've covered here in the big picture also with some of your guests, but what we know right now is that global economies are slowing down, and that includes the United States. But asset classes of categories are rising just as they were falling last fall. I'm curious, though, Jim, what do you think accounts for that? And before you answer that, I want to know who has it right, or which asset, I should say, has it right, stocks or bonds?
You know, Chris, I'll always side with the bond market. Just historically, I found it to be a better indicator. But let's take a look at what happens to explain this. Much of what you've seen here to explain much of this is the reversal that we've seen from major central banks, starting out with the ECB and then eventually the Fed. And what they've done is they've done a flip. They've gone from hawkish to dovish, especially the Fed. We've seen the drop in yields. That reflects the slowing economy that we've been talking about. The economy began to slow down in the third quarter. It continues to this day. The rise in bonds, utilities, consumer staples, REITs, and even junk bonds reflects really a search for yields as interest rates have dropped, gone negative, or lower here. Here's the thing that fascinates me. Interest rates on the 10-year Treasury are lower today than when the Fed first started to raise interest rates back in 2015. Now, the rise in stocks are probably the result of the Fed backing off from its hawkish stance. Commodities are rising. In my opinion, I believe on the probability of a trade deal with China. The Fed is going soft, and in some cases, we're seeing inventory shortages like in copper or silver or increasing demand for oil.
So you've just mentioned a kind of a list of things that are having an impact. What do you think is the end result? How does this play out in your estimation?
You know, you can see almost the opposite of what happened last year. Last year, the economy was strong along with corporate profits as a result of the tax cuts and the additional $300 billion of fiscal spending that the government authorized at the beginning of the year. Now, the Fed used that opportunity to raise interest rates, but in my opinion, they raised them too far when they raised them again in December. I mean, they just kept going, assuming, and you could see this. These guys were looking at a lagging indicator. They were looking at all the stimulus, the increase in corporate profits, and they were just raising rates, and just assuming. I mean, remember all the talk from what we saw happen in September, which began to make the market nervous because the economy did slow down in the third quarter, and there were indications it was slowing down even further for the fourth. But the Fed was giving speeches. They were confident about the economy, confident about where unemployment, where economic growth would be. Notice how all of that changed in January based after that, especially not only the rate hike in December, but also the FOMC press conference where basically the Fed said, hey, QT is on automatic pilot. So they used that to raise interest rates, and they raised it too far, in my opinion. This is the one thing that these guys are always looking in the rearview mirror. And the problem is monetary policy always operates with the lag, either when they're cutting rates to stimulate the economy or raising rates to slow down the economy. And the reason there is so much debt in our economy and globally, this created problems not only here for our own economy, but overseas as a result of rising interest rates, because you have something like $9 trillion in emerging market debt that's denominated in dollars. So the dollar strengthening, interest rates rising, and then add in that the trade war. So you saw the ECB and the Fed, they've all backed off from their hawkish positions. The Mueller report is out, so the risk of impeachment is gone. So what's left? It leaves the trade war. The market, I believe, is moving on the assumption that the Fed will stay on the sidelines and that the trade war will get resolved by the summer. So you could see the opposite of what we saw last year, where the economy picks up in the second half of this year versus the weakening trend we're seeing now. So here's the question. Is this already being priced in the stock market because stock markets are anticipatory of events before they happen? But sooner rather than later, I believe the true trend should emerge and those cross currents will resolve themselves.
So if I'm an investor and I'm hearing you say that you anticipate the Fed staying on the sidelines. Well, that's great news. And you mentioned that the trade war may get resolved by the summer. That has to be great news too. So if we're thinking as an investor right now, what should an investor be doing? Because it sounds like there's really good news on the horizon.
You know, as I said, since the beginning of the year, we're still playing defense. I think you'd have to be suicidal if you're fully invested in stocks right now, because this thing could change on a dime. It could take a tweet. It could take a comment by a Fed chairman or a Fed governor. But because when it gets resolved, and if the problems emerge, you're going to see a repeat so much of what we saw last February and when the years were given back in a single week, or quite honestly, what we saw last fall when all the gains of the year in just about every asset class evaporated in about 6 weeks. So today's markets, here's the problem, run by algo traders. And unlike the big investment banks, these guys are thinly capitalized. What does that mean? The moment trouble erupts in the market, they pull their bids, and all of a sudden liquidity evaporates, which magnifies any downside selling pressure that emerges as a result of troubles that we see in the credit markets, or for that matter, in the stock markets. There's just too many cross currents right now to go on to make any long-term commitments. In other words, there isn't a real clear trend. The other aspect that is difficult to predict, and we've seen this throughout this recovery, is government interference in the financial markets. So much of what has happened in this economic recovery has been unlike any recovery I've seen in my four decades in the business. It's been directed by the government, whether it was physical stimulus, as we saw in 2009 and 2010, and then once again in 2018 and 2019, or throw in central bank policy changes, as we saw with QE1 in 2009, QE2 2010, and QE3 in 2012. And it's changed throughout. We had the taper, we had the QE, then we had QT, and we just got the reversal. And I'll throw this one out. How do you predict a presidential tweet?
Well, I think if Rosie O'Donnell tweets, then you can predict a presidential tweet. But folks, stay tuned as we'll be following these events. We'll keep you abreast whenever we see changes coming about. In fact, we're going to put a graph of credit spreads and the stock market on our podcast page. It illustrates the reverse correlation between the rising credit spreads and the stock market, and that'll illustrate really why we spend so much time following these markets. And so, Jim, again, we've talked about a number of things on the horizon that can make an impact, some of these being hopefully really good news for the market. But what do you see in the weeks ahead?
Coming up in the weeks ahead, we are going to get our first print on the economic numbers for GDP in the first quarter. Everybody expects a very low print. They're predicting somewhere around 1%. And Chris, we are just about to launch in here in the next week or so, corporate earnings. Now, what does that mean? Any company that has a stock buyback program has to go into a blackout period. In other words, they're forbidden of buying their stock back ahead of corporate earnings. So what pressure that will put on the stock market, we don't know. We're also going to be looking at what companies are going to be reporting in terms of their earnings. Will they be slowing down? I mean, year over year comparisons are going to be very tough compared to last year when they instituted the drop in corporate tax rates. And more importantly, we're going to be looking at what companies are saying about the quarters ahead. And then, of course, we're going to be watching this trade deal. So of all the risks that we talked about at the beginning of the year, political risk, that's been resolved. Fed policy mistake, well, I still think they went too far in December, but at least the Fed is on hold for the rest of the year. And I want to put a caveat there at the moment. These guys can change if all of a sudden you see a spike in interest rates as a result of, let's say, rising commodity prices and rising oil. So the big things ahead, I would say, are probably corporate earnings, the economic numbers, and especially what we start to see in the LEIs in the second quarter. Because typically, the second quarter of the year is the strongest quarter throughout the year. So if the LEIs are looking weak heading into the second quarter, look for the Fed to start changing its tune and hinting at possible rate cuts. Right now, the futures market has a high probability of rate cuts coming later on in this year. We'll see if that happens. But those are the things we're going to be looking at. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.